time for The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist on-air show is heard every Saturday morning, 7:30 a.m. in northeastern Ohio on WJCU 88.7 FM and streamed at WJCU.org. Our weekly podcast is available at the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com or download it with your favorite podcatching app to listen anytime. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. This is our show for February 1st, 2020. Tomorrow is the day they pull that poor rodent out of his hole, and I hope he bites the guy who pulls him out. Yes, indeed, January is behind us. March 1st is only 4 weeks away. That's always been my harbinger of spring, as people start realizing they put their bikes away with any of a number of issues in the fall, from flat tires to frayed cables, and the bike shop phones start ringing for service. And since I mentioned bike shops, good segue, my first guest is a bike shop owner, but not just your ordinary come-in-and-buy-something type of bike shop owner. Benita Warnes and her husband, Mr. Michael, who is a special guy unto himself, own and operate Midway. It's a bike shop and a bike supply company, two bike shops, in St. Paul, Minnesota. It all started with a young man who wanted a bike and couldn't afford one, not even a good used one. And from there, Mr. Michael Recycles Bicycles was born. Since 2004, they've given away over 8,500 bicycles, 719 of them in 2019 alone. What's even more impressive? It's the way they not only got into the bike supply business, but what they do after the sale that is so unusual. Then we head south from Cleveland to a little town called Cedarville, where we find Professor Jay Kinzinger, who not only teaches engineering, but also owns and operates Sojourn Cyclery, producing lovely bikes made of wood, especially black walnut, his favorite stock in trade. Jay's dad was a shopkeeper, and Jay fell in love with bikes and woodworking as a youngster. We'll talk with him in the second half of the show. Before we get to Benita from Midway Bike, I wanted to say a few words about our new partner, Bike Law. As I continue to work with the growing network of independently practicing bicycling attorneys and advocates from Bike Law, I see a committed group of people who are passionate about the work they do for all cyclists. If you push the pedals around, you're a cyclist, and Bike Law takes a comprehensive approach to the way its members advocate for our community and pursue cycling justice. With the unsettling increase in crashes and the continued fight for equitable consideration and treatment on our roadways, it's important that Bike Law is here to help educate, advocate, and if need be, represent those of us who choose two wheels over four. If you have questions, need advice, or find yourself in a situation where a bicycling attorney is necessary, contact BikeLaw.com. They're always there to help. So Benita Warnes is a very interesting woman. Not only does she do amazing things in the bike business, ready for this? She's also a gold medalist in women's roller skating at the national level. She just won gold again for her age group, 65 and older. Last time I was on roller skates, I broke my wrist. Anyway, she is a force to be reckoned with. Hi, Benita. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show this week.
Thank you for having me.
It is my pleasure. I don't usually have a chance to speak with people who are addressing the needs of bike shops. You will be an exception. And so tell us a bit about your background and about Mr. Michael.
Well, here's the story. In about 1997, in where we live here in St. Paul, they have neighborhood cleanups. And that's where people bring all the stuff that they can't get rid of through the normal trash hauling procedure. So these events are staffed by volunteers, and there are various stations that people are assigned to. Well, one of them was bicycles. And most people didn't want to do that job because dismantling bicycles for people who don't know anything about them is very tedious. And what the job was is that if a bike came in that was you know, kind of a cool looking kid bike, you were to put it in this trailer and it was going to go to this local charity. But otherwise you were supposed to dismantle the bike. Well, there were a lot of these bicycles that there was nothing wrong with them or so little wrong with them that it would be wasteful to dismantle them. Meanwhile, we had a neighbor boy who, he was very low income. He had nothing. And he and his grandpa would go through the alleys of Minneapolis looking for scrap metal. And this little boy used to get these bicycles that he'd find dumped in alleys, and he'd bring them to us and ask if we would fix them for him. And some of them were way too far gone. Well, the bikes they wanted us to take a part of this event were far better than anything that this family had. So we grabbed some bikes and some parts and squirreled it away in our truck, took it home and outfitted his family and his cousins and some of the neighborhood kids. And that's how Mr. Michael Recycles Bicycles, which is our retail shop, got started. That's basically the story. For 10 years, we gave away bicycles out of our garage. It got us to thinking how many other neighborhoods are discarding stuff that could be used by other people. And so we started volunteering around town at the other neighborhood cleanups, and we were gathering the bicycles there. We would tear down the junky ones on site, but we would bring back to with us the other stuff. And the operation over time grew, and it got too big to be in our garage. So we started renting garages around town. And it got to the point where we needed to come up with a more formal arrangement. So in 2008, we incorporated, and I was looking for garage spaces closer to home so I could consolidate all of the storage at one location. And the place I found had a bunch of storage garages in the back, but it was also a mixed-use building with apartments and commercial spaces, and they had one commercial vacancy. Price was very reasonable. So we signed a lease and we opened a bike shop. We really didn't go into this thinking we were going to open a retail establishment, but the bike shop gave us heated indoor space because prior to that we had been doing this in our garage year round, which meant on some pretty cold days, we'd have to go out there until we couldn't stand it and come back in and warm up. It was within our budget. So at that point, we started selling used parts, used accessories, some used bicycles, and all of that with the idea that we were going to run it to break even. And here we are almost 12 years later, and the shop is successful. We just had our biggest year ever financially. We gave away 719 bicycles last year, and we were a pretty high production operation. I just tallied up the number of bicycles we've given away because I have numbers going back to 2004, and it came to 8,805. So basically our model is this. We are a business, not a nonprofit, because I didn't want to deal with a board of directors and I did not want to write grants. So what we did was we formed a business. We sell stuff. We sell enough stuff to pay the bills so that we can give bicycles away to people in need. And that's really how Mr. Michael got started.
Okay. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Benita Warnes. We're talking to her about Mr. Michael
Recycles Bicycles.
Okay. And now you actually, wait, I have a question about that model though. And that question has to do with what were you doing before you did this? Do you have another source of income?
Well, back when we started, both of us were employed full-time as engineers.
Aha.
For the Postal Service, and my husband worked for a small electronics recycling company. And so I retired from my postal job in 2009. My husband lost his job 4 years ago. They closed the plant and laid everybody off. We live frugally, and we've saved, and we live off of my pension, and then he has taken some retirement money out so that we can pay our bills while we are doing Mr. Michael, because it is an all-volunteer operation.
Right.
No one gets paid at the shop, including us, and we don't intend to take a salary for it because we treat it as a ministry and as a calling.
Well, you have to understand that, you know, if you want to make money in the bicycle business, you have to start with twice as much as you think you want to make, right? That's
well,
just
yes and no.
I know. It's sort of a joke, but...
Well, actually, we tell people we have two bicycle businesses, so we can lose twice as much money twice.
Let's talk about Midway, which is your wholesale end. How did you decide to get into that end of the business?
Well, he tried to get a wholesale account. Once we opened the shop, it's pretty difficult to recover enough of the consumable items like cables, housings, tires, and tubes from bicycles we're discarding to be able to properly fix the bikes. And so we got to the point where we wanted to establish a supplier relationship. Unfortunately, because our model was so unusual, most of the supply companies didn't want anything to do with us. In fact, one major supplier, when I applied, told the first reason we were rejected is because we didn't have a dedicated landline in our shop. Now, that was 2009. And I was already carrying a smartphone in 2009. So it was basically an excuse to make us go away. Well, then later on, the excuse is you don't spend enough money. We weren't a high enough dollar account to make it worth their while to sell me stuff. And the other distribution company that I looked into, they had a 6-page form in ultra fine print asking you to sign away your personal assets to guarantee that you'll pay for your parts. And I'm not signing an intrusive document like that. You form a corporation for that purpose.
Right.
So we found the wholesale end of things to be onerous and certainly not friendly to a small shop like ourselves. And we had to think that there were other shops that were in the same boat. Meanwhile, we were purchasing stuff. We found a little bitty distribution company that was actually right in our backyard, like a mile away. And it had been in business for many years. But the owner was getting up in years and had physical health issues and that. And so I was buying some stuff from them, but they were always out of stuff. And it took them 6 months to get stuff from Taiwan, and I couldn't wait that long for a box of cables. So I suggested to him he sell me the business. And he said, well, I'll think about it. And so he called me several months later and was interested in selling to me. So at that point, we incorporated and got everything set up, found space and all of that. But unfortunately, the gentleman was way too emotionally attached to his business and really wasn't quite ready to sell. And so he started throwing up roadblocks. And the day before the closing on the transaction, which was 3 days before Christmas, he pulled out of the deal.
Wow.
Well, we'd already invested quite a bit of money in all of the legal documents and incorporating and putting money down on a space. And we looked at each other and said, what do we do? Do we go forward or do we just consider that an education in the world of business and move on and take the loss? We decided to go for it because we really felt like we needed to have a distribution company, and we realized that bridge now was burned and we couldn't buy from them anymore either. So we were really up against the wall. So I started cold calling manufacturers, asking them to sell me stuff, and I offered to pay cash up front because the money we were going to pay him for the corporation was the money we now had to use to stock the warehouse. So, and a lot of manufacturers turned me down cold. They wouldn't sell to me. And some of them wouldn't sell to me because they say, well, we're just not looking for another distributor right now. But what they were really telling me is they were afraid that somehow I was going to provide some competition to some of the existing accounts that they had, where the existing accounts might get mad or something. I really detected that undertone in what they were saying. And so I was truly the underdog. But we did get some people to sell us stuff. We did secure a broker in Taiwan that we can buy a lot of the stuff that we need from. And so we moved forward to start a company. And then we started going around calling on bike shops locally. Then I saw an online posting for Cabda.
Right.
Because we'd been to Interbike, but Interbike was something that was totally out of reach for us as a small company. There's no way we could afford to go and exhibit there or anything. But we saw this Cabda, and it was regional, and we knew we could drive there. And So I called up Jim Kirsten and asked him about the prices. And he told me, and I said, well, I think that's doable. It's, you know, we need to get our name out there somehow. And this seems to be the way to get in front of a whole lot of customers rather than having to go around the bike shops cold calling people. So we said, well, I said, but we've never done a trade show before. And Jim says, well, I've never put one on before. So from that day forward, we've been friends. And Jim and the CABDA folks have just treated us fantastic. They're so easy to deal with. They're wonderful people. So we went down and exhibited at the first CABDA, signed up 8 accounts, started getting our name out there. And it started making a difference in our company's growth.
Let me remind our listeners again, we're speaking with Benita Warnes. We're going to take a real short break. And when we come back, I'm going to ask her about things like, who's her customer? Why is her business so different? And how she's seen the bicycle business change in the past few years. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
He's almost famous. He's Mr. Michael. He fixes bicycles both big and small. 520 Prior is where you find him in the Midway area of St. Paul. So buy some bike parts or get your bike fixed at the most fun bike shop in this town. So check our website for our hours at mmrbstore.com.
I'm Mr. Michael, and I approve of this message.
We are back. If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Benita Warnes. She is one of the co-owners of Midway Bike in St. Paul, Minnesota. And she's actually, a couple of things. They have this really interesting recycle bike business, which is a ministry of a sort where they give bikes away. And it sort of forced them into a position to become a wholesaler, selling to other bike shops. Who is your customer? And what makes your business so different from the big guys like QBP and J&B and Holley and the other people that bike shops try to become, you know, customers of and sometimes fail?
Okay. Well, our customer is typically a one-shop location. It's typically a family-owned type of business. That's one of our typical customers. And they are looking for a company that sells the items that they need to fix the regular bikes, not the high-end stuff. And so they're looking to buy stuff like above-bar shifters and 6- and 7-speed derailleurs and stuff that's been around for quite a while. And it's the kind of stuff that's on a lot of the low-end bikes that are out there in the world. That's one of our typical customers. Another important customer for us is the nonprofit world. Just about every major city has at least one, if not several, nonprofit bicycle shops or programs. Some of them run retail operations where they sell stuff. Some of them are places where people go and earn a bike and they learn how to repair bikes. They volunteer and that sort of thing. Some of them are educational, where they're teaching people how to ride bikes. Some of them are in schools, where they're teaching people how to fix bikes. So there's a variety of these nonprofit programs around the country that don't fit the normal retail mold. And their need isn't for carbon fiber parts and suspension forks and all that other kind of high-end stuff. What they need are the basic parts to fix the bikes that they get. They don't have enough money to spend $500 and $600 for in order to get to the threshold of free shipping or to meet the minimum order requirements that the large suppliers have established as a way they're not interested in small orders. And another important customer for us are small mobile operations, people who are running a mobile repair business from a van. Now, these are not hobbyists that are Craigslist flippers in their garage. These are people who have a legitimate business. They have insurance. They have licensing in their state. They have state tax ID number and so on. But their van is their store. They don't operate a bricks and mortar, and their business is primarily focused on repair. So we have a number of those customers as well. And those customers have had tremendous difficulty accessing wholesale pricing, as have a lot of the nonprofits because they don't operate a retail store. And even some of the small mom and pop, they get frustrated because they don't want to spend $600 when all they need is a box of cables and, you know, a couple of derailleurs and some grips, for example. When we started, we had a $25 minimum, but we realized that wasn't really necessary. So we have no minimum at all. So if somebody wants to call up and order just one tool, we will ship them just one tool. Now, that customer does pay the shipping, but we also charge the customer exactly what it costs to ship the item. We don't have any extra handling, surcharges, and other sorts of things. And currently, we offer free shipping to our customers if they spend $300, which is lower than most of the other places. The other thing that makes our company very different, aside from no minimums and being able to order in small quantities, is the fact that we give 10% of all the income that comes in to charity.
10% of income, not 10% of after cost net.
No, 10% of income. That is correct. And the way we do it at the retail shop, our volunteers, we have a core group of about six, and our volunteers have helped us with finding charities, and most of the charities are very local and right in our neighborhood. We know where the money's going. We see who the beneficiaries are. It works really well. So our wholesale operation, we wanted to include our customers more in the process of choosing the charities. So a couple of months ago, we sent out in one of our newsletters a request for them to nominate charities that we would make some selections from a list. And so we chose three charities that we thought would have pretty broad appeal amongst our customers. One of the criteria was that they could not be eligible to get an account at Midway because we wanted no conflict of interest
right there.
But now each of our customers can tell us which of these charities, if they have a preference for one of them, they can choose that charity and we will donate 10% of whatever they spend with us this year to that specific charity. The first one is the Anne Bancroft Foundation. Anne Bancroft is a world famous polar explorer, and she and Leif Arneson went to the South Pole. The two of them skied to the South Pole and all the way across the continent of Antarctica. And she also went to the North Pole with Will Seeger. And she's still involved in different types of expeditions and is a very dynamic person. She founded a nonprofit where they give micro grants to girls to pursue their dreams. The grants typically are $500. There are two kinds. There are Let Me Play, and which are sports oriented, and then there's Dare to Dream, which are just about anything else. It's open to all. There's no specification there. So the Anne Bancroft Foundation is one of them. The second one is the Habitat for Humanity Bike Home. Every year, Habitat for Humanity has a 500-mile bike ride that anyone from around the country can sign up and do as a fundraiser for Habitat. And anyone who rides this can designate the Habitat affiliate that's back in their hometown, or they can choose the bike home as who they raise the money for. And the goal of the bike home is to raise enough money from the ride to build one Habitat house. So what we will do is, we will contact Habitat and find out if they have a rider that is having difficulty raising funds, and then whatever funds are given to the bike home, we will then give them to Habitat, and then that can be that rider's sponsorship. But it, all the money, 100% of that money goes to the bike home. It doesn't go to the rider. So that's number two. And then number three is one that we became aware of that is in Portland, Oregon. It is called the Lemonade Project. Or is it? No, wait a minute. I think it's Project Lemonade.
It is Project Lemonade. I know about it.
You do? Well, that's excellent. And Project Lemonade, of course, is they run a store every year in the fall for back-to-school period so that children who are in the foster care system, and especially teenagers, can shop for stylish clothing at no charge to them, but that they can fit in better at school because they'll have, you know, clothes that are like everyone else's instead of some stuff that's from some closet someplace where they were forced to go quickly because they had to abandon their things. And so we felt like that was a very worthy charity. And one of the things they're trying to do is to develop a year-round store. The thing I liked about this particular group is that they are very transparent in their finances, and they publish all of their, they publish their stuff online so you can see exactly how they spend their money. And it is all volunteer. So we thought that they were worthy, and that was one of the ones that we chose. So those are the three, and any Midway customer can choose to support one of them, two of them, or all three of them. If they don't specify after we've asked them, then we're going to divide the money equally between the three.
Let me remind our listeners once again, we're speaking with Benita Warnes. She is with Midway Bike, a very small distributor to bike shops around the country, and MMRB, Mr. Michael Recycles Bikes, their nonprofit arm. But it seems like there's a lot of nonprofit arm no matter what we do. So you just returned from Cab to West. How was the show for you?
Well, we go to Cab to West as a distributor, so we actually exhibit at Cab to West.
Right.
And it was a very good show for us. In fact, the level of conversations that we had with bike shops out in Southern California was much more in-depth and had meaningful conversations with us. We opened a number of new accounts that we anticipate we'll be seeing some sales from those. But even more important, a lot of folks out there hadn't heard of us, and it was an opportunity for them to hear about us. There's others that had heard of us because of our email newsletter, which we have, I think it's about 3,700 people on the email list. And so we send out newsletters once or twice a month. We don't go into great detail. We just have like two or three paragraphs just updating folks on what's going on, and we send that out. And a number of the shops there said, yeah, we get your newsletter. So then it sparked more interest so that they would, when they met us face to face and could ask us more questions, and that led to them opening accounts. So we will see how that translates into sales for us.
So are you going, obviously you'll be at Chicago Midwest, I would think, because that's not too far from you.
We will definitely stick with the Chicago show regardless of the other shows.
I have just a couple of more things to ask you. One is, as you look forward, I think bike shops in general, many bike shops, are sort of floundering right now because they are seeing Amazon, they are seeing people like Chain Reaction, big online sellers, kind of biting away at their business. It looks to me like in the next few years, Midway might just be a resource that will help some of these people who can't meet some of these minimums, number one, and who maybe want to look at diving back into the kinds of business that will be profitable for them in the future because you can't compete with the company stores like Trek and Specialized.
Yes, there is competition from the internet, and yes, there's competition with the big brands, and everybody knows that, and everybody agrees on that, but I don't think that that's the number one problem. What I think is this. The vast majority of the bikes, and while I don't have empirical evidence to support this figure, my gut feeling is it's in the area of 85 to 90% of all the bicycles, and I'm talking new and used, are not sold in bike shops. Whether or not they're sold online, whether or not they're sold at large discount department stores or some of the mass market sporting goods stores, at secondhand stores, from flippers on Craigslist or at garage sales,
or from shops that sell and service used bicycles. That's where the majority of bikes are sold in this country. There are far more of those bicycles than there are of the higher end stuff. Also, you know, while people say, okay, so unemployment is down, people are getting jobs, but the average wage of those jobs people are getting is just not a living wage. And there are many parts of the country where the vast majority of people can't afford most of the things that are in bike shops. Meanwhile, the bike shops focus all of their attention on the 5% of the industry that are enthusiasts that want the expensive bikes. And okay, yeah, you make a little more money on selling an expensive bike than you would on selling a cheap bike. That's a given. But there are far more people out there that are in need of a basic bike, and that's what they're looking for, than there are what we call the mammals. And so, you know, the industry ignores that Hispanic immigrant male that is riding the bike to and from their job. If you look around in any major city, if you really look for them, you'll start seeing them. They're known as the invisible riders. You'll see them riding down the sidewalk slowly, but they're just on their way to a job. Most of them don't have any bike-specific clothing on. They're not wearing helmets a lot of times, which kind of bothers me. I wish I had enough money to give them all helmets. But there's a whole slew of people out there who just need a basic bike. Or there are people out there who are trying to be environmentally responsible by not creating a whole bunch more new stuff when there's stuff that already exists that will meet their needs and so use up the things that we have and be green. So there's a lot of people like that, and the bike industry totally ignores that, the basics. And that's where Midway comes in, because shops that are willing to take on service of those kinds of bikes and are willing to provide refurbished used bikes at affordable prices and provide repair services for those bikes where people can actually get the parts rather than, oh, it breaks and they have to get a whole nother bike because you can't afford the part at a lot of bike shops. That's where we come in, because we try to find that stuff to service those bikes.
So I have two more things. One is going to be about how listeners will find out about more about MMRB and about Midway. The other is, so Steve from Bicycle Retailer, who's on the show a lot,
yeah,
sort of intimated that you might sing for me.
Let me explain. There's a local radio station that plays oldies, and their advertising rates are very reasonable, and we advertise on there. Only I write our ads and perform our ads. But the latest one, in keeping with the format of the station, is a sung jingle. And so I've actually have Mr. Michael sitting here next to me. And what I'm going to do, I will sing you the jingle, but there's a tagline afterwards. So when I stop singing, he will come in with the tagline. So
sing for me, Benita.
Okay. He's almost famous. He's Mr. Michael. He fixes bicycles both big and small. 520 Pryor is where you find him in the Midway area of St. Paul. So buy some bike parts or get your bike fixed at the most fun bike shop in this town. So check our website for our hours at mmrbstore.com.
I'm Mr. Michael, and I approve of this message.
Oh, my God, that was so awesome. I'm not only going to use it in the interview, I'm using it before we even start the interview. You are giving me permission to do that right now, yes?
Oh, absolutely. That, of course, tells you how to get more information, which our website is mmrbstore.com. So you can find out all about Mr. Michael on there. It's not a real slick website. It's a basic website, but it does the job for us, and I'm just trying to update some things. But the website building is not one of my better skills.
I got everything I needed from it. Well, this has just been delightful. I really like what you're doing. Benita Warrens, and somewhere Mr. Michael's in the background. Thank you so much for talking with me today. I hope you have a great 2020 season.
Okay, thank you.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Benita Warrens joined me from Midway Bike Supply and MMRB Mr. Michael Recycles Bicycles in St. Paul, Minnesota. If you're interested in knowing more about them and their work, you can log on to midwaybike.com. So before we take a short break, I wanted to catch you up on our question from last week and pose one for the coming week. I asked, what app do you use to download the podcast? And I learned about some apps I never knew were out there, but there really wasn't a clear winner. iTunes or Apple Podcasts and Overcast seem to be fairly popular, with a smattering of many different ones. So here's this week's question. Do you have a mileage goal for 2020? And if so, what is it? Okay, that's really two questions, I know. Let's take that short break, and when we return, we're going to talk with Jay Kinzinger from Sojourn Cyclery in Cedarville, Ohio. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
I'm your host, Diane Jenks. Right in the middle of the Little Miami Scenic Trail System in southern Ohio, one of the best trail systems anywhere, lies the little town of Cedarville. And right in the town of Cedarville is Sojourn Cyclery, one of the only builders of handcrafted wood bikes. Let me introduce you to Jay Kinzinger, professor, woodworker, bike builder. Hi, Jay. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show this week.
Thank you, Diane.
It's really good to connect with somebody making beautiful handcrafted bikes right here in Ohio, and I know where you live. So I've spent some time in Cedarville, Ohio, staying at the Hearthstone Inn, which you said is about a mile from your house. Tell us a little bit about you and Sojourn, but we were talking before we went on air, and you told me that you're a professor at Cedarville University and at Ohio State. Is that where you are, Columbus?
No, actually, that's a little confusing.
Okay.
I'm a professor at Cedarville University, and we have a branch campus in Columbus.
Ah.
And so, yeah, the school in Columbus is actually a school of industrial design. So I wear two hats. I teach engineering at the main campus in Cedarville. And then twice a week, I drive to Columbus to teach the industrial designers.
What kind of engineering are you teaching?
Okay, so my degree is mechanical engineering and biomedical engineering. So I kind of will teach those type of courses, a lot of kind of hands-on manufacturing. I teach the capstone courses, the kind of grand finale, those types of courses.
I don't know how many bike builders are engineers, but I would say that if we were to line them all up, we've got a ton of them. So it doesn't surprise me that you're an engineer. So tell me how you decided to actually build bicycles. Obviously, you don't need to do that. You have a what they call a day job, a real job.
Well, Diana, goes way back. I mean, I've been in love with bicycles as long as I could pedal one. My first job was in a bicycle shop when I was 14. I worked my way through high school and college in bicycle shops. So I started actually building steel frames when I was still in high school. Back then, you could actually mail order a kit called Proteus. Proteus would sell a kit, and a box would show up at your door with, you know, lugs and steel tubing and the drops. And I can't imagine they could do that today with liability concerns, but in a little thin paperback book. And I built my first frame and was sort of hooked. I pedaled that first frame, the bicycle with that frame on the Bike Centennial Trail back in, well, I did it in 1981, but that was the maiden voyage. And so, you know, bicycles and frame building. It's been in my blood for a while. Yeah, that's kind of how it started.
You mentioned Proteus. As I remember, they were out of Maryland. I think we still have our Proteus book on the shelf with all of our other gazillion bicycle books. But I don't remember ever our getting the bike kit, but I do remember people doing it. Was that Reynolds tubing at the time?
Yes, Reynolds 531. And my first attempt at it was a disaster, you know. Kind of a little known fact of frame building is what they call cold forming. You know, anytime you weld metal, it's going to move. And with just brute force, sometimes you have to force it back into position. But I wasn't aware of that as an 18-year-old. And so I ended up having a pretty crooked frame initially. Then I started making fixtures and so forth and learned a few things and finally got a successful bike.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Jay Kinzinger. I hope I'm saying that correctly.
That's close enough. Oh, Kinzinger.
Kinzinger, yep. Okay. He is the founder and owner of Sojourn Cyclery down in Cedarville, Ohio, right?
Yeah. That's correct.
It's Cedarville, yeah. So I used to go down to Yellow Springs, which is just a few miles down the road, and do a workshop down there while Brian rode all the fabulous trails, my husband, on all around, and, you know, starting at the Hearthstone Inn a mile from your house. So how did you decide to suddenly go from steel to wood as opposed to maybe, you know, aluminum or tie or even carbon? What gave you that inspiration to start making bicycles out of wood?
Well, you know, I always did it as a hobby, building frames of steel. And that's probably the easiest way for a somewhat novice. You know, it's a pretty steep learning curve to do titanium and aluminum. And frankly, I'm better with a torch than I am with a TIG welder. So I stuck with steel, made a triplet for my family. Sort of my ambition, I've got four kids. My ambition was, ever since they were infants, trying to figure out ways to get them on a bicycle. And that took a lot of different forms. And, you know, so I made a triplet and tandem and all kinds of things. But then I've also had this underlying love for woodworking. My dad was a shop teacher, so I grew up having access to a really nice wood shop. And I just love to work with wood. And I started seeing these wooden frames pop up on the internet, and they were really intriguing. And I thought, well, you know, that's a neat way to combine two of my passions, bicycle frame building and woodworking. So I took a crack at it, and probably 400 hours later, I had my first wooden frame. So the first one was a pretty steep learning curve, but yeah, that's, I like to say, I traded silver brazing for sawdust.
Well, and silver brazing needs to be done in a fairly clean environment. Sawdust, not so much.
That's right.
They are stunning. The bicycles are beautiful. How do you choose the wood that you're going to use to get the durability and the ride characteristics and the weight and all of those things that you want?
Right. Yeah. Well thank you. There's probably a number of woods that could be used. I like the look of walnut. It's been one of my favorite woods to use, to work with. It just has a beautiful tone. It's relatively lightweight. It's very stable. You might say it's been extremely well field tested because gun stocks are typically made of walnut. So they've been in all kinds of weather and those kind of characteristics attract me to walnut, but I know some builders use ash, and ash is a fine wood. And, you know, there are a few to choose from, some that you'd want to avoid. You wouldn't want to use something like cedar because it would split too easily. But, you know, I kind of landed on walnut just because I love it and has a decent strength to weight ratio. Yeah.
Where do you find it? I mean, you're not cutting down trees probably, or are you?
Well, I'm not cutting them down, but they're being blown down. I mean, we're kind of Tornado Alley here. And just last, I think it was Memorial Day, we had a big tornado come through and people catch wind that I built walnut bikes. Well, this guy said, I've got this massive walnut tree that blew down in my yard. You can have it if you want to process it. it was a massive thing. I had to hire a crane to load it to take it to the sawmill. But, you know, talk about having something very sustainable as your material. You know, I'm literally out there with a chainsaw cutting this tree into boards. And it's drying right now. I'll probably be able to use it in a year or so.
So when you look at the bikes, and you can see them online, you can go to sojourncyclery.com and take a look at them. First of all, they're just gleamingly beautiful, but I'm not saying lugs. How are you actually forming the frames and then, I don't want to say attaching one thing to another, because, you know, I think of lugs, or I think of TIG welding, or I think of, not much else, really.
Yeah, it's a different breed of cat, for sure. You know, the first frame I mentioned, I did with a lot of hand work, you know, using a handheld router and making templates and fixtures to guide the router, and then a good old-fashioned gouge, you know. The frames are hollow, so that is something people are sometimes surprised by, that the frames have a wall thickness of 5 to 6 millimeters. So they're hollow in the middle, and that, you know, takes some carving out. So my first frames were done that way, with templates and routers and gouges, files. Now I've got a computer numeric control machine, a CNC. And the CNC has seriously shortened the lead time on building a frame. So, you know, the frame starts out as a CAD drawing, a computer-aided design drawing, and I can transfer that drawing into another program that writes code that the machine will understand. And then it's a matter of just, you know, positioning the blank, I call it, on the tabletop, and putting the correct tools in and pushing the button. And sounds easier than it really is, but that's in essence how it's done.
Okay, I want to pull this up here so I can take a look at it again. I've looked at it like 3 million times, but I want to look at it again. So, all right, let's take a look at your Diverso, your all-around single frame.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm looking at the top tube and how it sort of is part of the head tube, which is part of the down tube, which is part of the bottom bracket. And I'm wondering, what is it that holds it all together? You're not making it in one piece, right?
Right. Yeah, that's a great question. You know, it's sort of like a kind of a unibody, almost like a carbon fiber frame. So I make it in two halves, like a clamshell. And wood is not going to be able to sustain the hoop stresses that you would, you know, for bearings and so forth. So I do put steel sleeves in where the bearings are pressed. So there's a steel sleeve on the head tube, the seat tube, and the bottom bracket.
Okay.
But everything else is, just imagine two halves of a bicycle. And then I epoxy in the steel, and I put cable guides in, so all the cables are internal. And then I sandwich that metal between the two halves and epoxy the two halves together. And then the chain stays and seat stays are attached later on. They're a secondary operation with a special fixture. So you do the main triangle as sort of a clamshell, and then the back end is positioned after the fact.
Yeah, and then it's an aftermarket fork. You're not making forks.
I'm not making forks. I mean, I make steel forks.
Right. No, but I meant you're not making...
No, I'm not making wooden forks.
That'd be like having wooden teeth today, probably, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, probably not the best idea.
Let me remind our listeners again, we're speaking with Jay Kinzinger. He is the proprietor of Sojourn Cyclery. Beautiful wooden frames. You'll be at NABS this year in Dallas. Is this your first year at the North American Handmade Bike Show?
No, ma'am. My first year was in Charlotte in 2014. Then I went to Louisville in 2015, skipped a year, went to Salt Lake in 2017.
Good. Well, good. Then you know the ropes and how that works. So let me ask you two questions about the actual bike itself once it's built. For somebody who is used to riding, let's say, metal, steel tie or aluminum, or carbon, what would you notice about the ride characteristics? Now, I know that bamboo bikes ride a certain way. I've actually ridden a bamboo tandem. It was okay. I mean, I didn't fall in love with it. But there's a reason for that. It was not perfected yet. It was a prototype. So I would imagine that today's might be better. But tell me what your bike would ride like, most like, or what would somebody experience that they would either fall in love with or not?
Okay. To me, and, you know, I'm kind of a retro grouch, I love the ride of a steel frame. You know, to me, you know, I've ridden a steel frame bicycle virtually all over the world, you know. So the wooden frame has a very similar feel to steel. It's perhaps a little bit more compliant than steel, but what's remarkable about the wood frame is it absorbs the road vibration. So it's an incredibly smooth and quiet ride, really, really nice. You know, I've ridden carbon frames, and, you know, carbon frames are pretty non-compliant, okay? You feel a lot, same with aluminum. And you know, not all carbon frames are created equal. I understand that. But the one that I rode, it's really loud. I mean,
they are loud.
Yeah, the road noise just resonated through the frame. And you don't get that with a wooden frame. It's very, very quiet, very smooth.
I already like that. That is one of my biggest complaints about carbon is it sounds like a plastic bike and it feels like a plastic bike. So what typically, let's just take forgetting the e-bike for a moment. And I do want to talk about your e-bike. I absolutely do. But just take a typical single bike, and I don't know how you measure your bikes, but let's just say a medium size, 58 centimeter maybe. What would it weigh as a frame set, and what would it weigh as a complete bike? Because that's, you know, people are going to ask the question, not that it really truly matters, but.
Right. Well, thank you for that caveat, because I have a strong opinion about that.
Yeah, I'll bet you do.
But everybody does ask the question, and I'm even guilty of testing a bike when I go into a bike shop. You know, it's just sort of a natural reaction. The frame will weigh sub 5 pounds. For like a 58. So right in there with a quality steel frame and aluminum frame. So the frame set, now minus the fork, somewhere around, you know, 4.5 pounds. And, you know, I've had them built out with, you know, carbon fiber for 18 pounds complete. You know, the bike I ride is kind of a gravel grinder, and it's more like 25 pounds. I'm tall, so I ride a 62 centimeter. I hope that gives you a decent idea.
No, it gives me a great idea. So there's a tandem here. I'm a tandem rider. I'm a stoker. It's really beautiful. No lateral. You have no lateral on it.
Right.
It's a regular tandem. So what kind of, I hate to use the word stiffness because it's just not the right word, but what kind of rigidity do you feel? Does it?
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
You know, it really floats down the road vertically. You know, my wife and I we've been riding tandems for 30 years, and we've never gotten to the point where we can stand up, you know, get out of the saddle to climb. I know a lot of more expert riders do that.
We can't either.
Okay. And in that scenario, I think you would notice that it's not as rigid as a steel frame. You know, you would probably notice a little more, let's call it whipping, okay?
Yeah.
But for normal kind of riding, you know, my son and I rode a loaded tandem from Mobile, Alabama to Lake Michigan, so kind of cross-country the skinny way. With panniers, we're self-supported. And, it worked. It was rigid enough for what we do. But if you're like an Uber rider that gets out of the saddle, may not be the best application.
Got it.
It literally just floats down the road. I mean, it's just, I mean, we've got a couple of steel tandems as well, and they're great. You know, nothing against steel at all. And weight-wise, they're pretty comparable. You know, I think the complete tandem frame, again, ours is a large one. It's about 9 pounds.
That's light. I think I'm not sure if ours is heavier or not. It's about to get couplers, so it's going to be heavier. No way about it. So I have a couple more questions before I let you go. I know you're busy. How long is your queue for a bike? I take it you build them as they're ordered?
Yes, that's correct. I like to say 3 months. I've been able to get it done a little bit quicker than that usually, but I try to under-promise and over-deliver.
There you go.
Depends on how busy I am.
Right, right. I understand that.
So I've been doing workshops lately. That's been kind of the new avenue that I've...
Oh, I saw that. Yeah. How does that work?
Well, it's really been fun. You know, I just threw it up on the website just to see what would happen. And a young lady from Apple called and contacted me, and she said, well, I want to do this. And I said, well, can you get some friends together? And so she ended up getting, so there was a total of four. And so my wife and I flew out there, and we shipped all our, you know, gear to build the frame. And over the course of a long weekend, it was like 3 days, four people were able to build their own bike. And, you know, that's remarkably fast. I mean, there's steel frame workshops that, you know, take at least a week.
Right.
You know, honestly, I did a lot of the heavy lifting ahead of time. I had the shells all completely carved out with the CNC. And so we basically put the frame together and spent our time finishing it and building the frame.
So wait, you're talking about Apple as in Apple the corporation?
Yes, ma'am.
How cool is that? How did she find you?
Well, she was just intrigued with wooden bicycles. And probably the 800-pound gorilla of the business was Renovo, and they went out of business.
Right.
You know, they were a commercial wooden frame builder. And she was kind of heartbroken, but, you know, dug into the internet and found me and found, like I said, I was just trying this out to see what would happen. She bid on it, no pun intended. She thought it was really cool, and she sent out an email company-wide and got tons of responses, but narrowed it down to four. And, I mean, we had a blast. I just, you know, I made some really good friends. You know, how else is a Hayseed from Ohio going to make friends with these computer science geniuses in Apple, you know? So it was a really cool connection.
I don't think you should probably denigrate yourself like that. Sounds to me like you've got it all over. Don't worry about that. You know, maybe we're from Ohio, but we know what we're doing. So I have two other questions. One is your e-bike, Electrico, is that what you're calling it?
Yes.
I assume you're using a Bosch motor?
Well, I would like to, but Bosch is not real keen about selling their stuff.
Really?
Little guy. Yeah.
Well, they need to like listen up because I think it's a big market. Okay, so how are you getting these? I assume are just pedal assist without throttle.
Yeah, it's a Shimano Step, which is an awesome system.
Yeah, it is.
There's nothing wrong with that at all. It's a fantastic system.
And how is that doing? Are you selling some? Are people ordering them?
Not really.
Okay.
You know, I really saw that as being like, and honestly, I took this on as a combined senior design project with some of my students at Cedarville, both in the engineering department and industrial design department. And, you know, we had big plans, and that's the bike that we ended up taking to Salt Lake City, NABS, and it just hasn't taken off. You know, maybe it's our location. You know, it takes a little while for things to migrate to Ohio from the right or left coast. But, you know, it's an awesome idea.
It's a nice looking bike.
Well, thank you. Yeah.
Yeah, it's very nice looking. Wow. Well, so what are you taking to NABS with you?
Well, I'm taking the Tandem, the e-bike, probably a gravel grinder. I made a giraffe unicycle out of wood, and I actually get amazing attraction to that thing. I built it just for kicks, and I brought it to the NABS in Louisville, and Gates Carbon Drive was there, and they saw it and they said, hey, if we give you our components, will you put it on your unicycle? And I said, you bet. So I've got a Gates belt carbon belt drive giraffe unicycle. It's a bit of a novelty.
Is it not on the site?
It is not. I mean, because I don't really sell it.
No, but it'd be fun to have a picture of it.
Yeah, you know, you're right. I should do that. I'm probably going to have this website updated before NABS anyway. So.
Well, we were in Louisville. Remember, it was, as I remember, we went down there and there was like nobody serving you because there was 17 inches of snow. It was really obnoxious, as I remember. Louisville doesn't know how to do snow, right?
That was a real, curveball for them. They right. There are people out in the road shoveling with a hand shovel.
And so many cars ditched on the side of the road. Yeah. It was funny.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry I missed you. I don't know why we didn't connect.
Who knows? So tell our listeners how to find out more about your work and where they can see all these beautiful bikes.
Okay. Well, the website is Sojourn Cyclery. And if you Google wooden bikes, I'll probably be one of the top three to pop up. So, yeah, that's probably an easy way to do it. If you're ever in Cedarville, Ohio, as you know and your husband know, we have an amazing network of bicycle trails, and people from all over the country come to Yellow Springs, Cedarville, and ride for hours and hours. So I'd be happy to show you my operation and let you try a bike out.
You also have a killer coffee shop in Cedarville. I'm sure they're still there. They are so good. We used to get up in the morning, go over to the coffee shop, then I'd go to my workshop, and Brian would get on the bike. So it's really nice down there. Jay, it has been a pleasure to talk with you. I wish you lots of luck with your selling season this year. Beautiful bicycles. We'll be down to Cedarville again sometime, and we'll stop in and say hello. Thanks so much.
Oh, please do, Diane. I'd like that very much. Looking forward to meeting you face-to-face. Thank you.
Uh-huh.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Sojourn Cyclery will be at NABS 2020 in Dallas next month. You can also see some of his work in action on YouTube at Sojourn Cyclery Building Process Overview, or you can follow Sojourn on Instagram and Facebook. My thanks to Jay and Benita Warnes for being my guests this week. I'll be back with a brand new show next week. Remember to weigh in on Facebook with our question, do you have a mileage goal for 2020? And if so, what is it? Thank you for listening. I hope you have a great week. Stay safe out there. And remember, if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.